Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show. Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, we have Tom Hurlburt. Tom is the principal architect of co-op architecture firm in South Dakota. They have offices in Sioux Falls, Aberdeen, and Rapid City. He is also the president of the Historical Society's Board of Trustees. Tom, welcome to History 605.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have worked together for 3 years in this current capacity, and over that time, you've become president, served on the board prior to me coming into this position, but on the History 605, mostly has been authors. We've had some filmmakers, but I think you're the first architect to come on the show, and after nearly 80 episodes, it's far too late in the repertoire to have an architect on the show, so I'm very glad you're here today to talk about how history is represented in architecture.
Thanks for having me, Ben. You know, there's probably a lot of other professions that would do better at articulating a lot of these history components. So you haven't made a mistake. If you've made a mistake, it might be having me as your first architectural guest, but I'm very excited to be here. You know, I also was recently appointed to the Capitol Complex Commission. I haven't been to any meetings on that, but I'm excited also
see what
I can do to help on the Capitol Complex as well. So. Yep. Thank you. It's been fun serving with you on the Board of Trustees for SHPO. It's a great and interesting organization that I knew very little about. I thought I did. And I keep learning stuff every time we have a meeting.
Right. Well, let's dive into that a little bit. One of the roles of the board is to nominate properties for the National Park Service Register of Historic Places. You have been part and parcel then of all those discussions about, you know, formally voting to nominate everything from a barn to a dance hall to churches, a wide variety of buildings across the state. What have you learned about South Dakota? Maybe a very broad question, but what have you learned about South Dakota just by sitting on the board and reviewing all these property and the nominations?
Well, in simplistic terms, there is a lot of beautiful architecture out there, a lot of craftsmen that took a lot of time and energy to build a lot of structures across South Dakota. That's evident. And it's the stories, the real pleasure, though, is the work that your staff does, because they present the stories behind the architecture or the structure. And that's just, it's a novel in of itself about, you know, some earlier time in South Dakota and about the people that built that. So it's like a history lesson every time we get a nomination. You know, interesting, not very long ago, we had some structures up at Fort Sisseton. And there's the history around that. And like you said, there's a lot of rural barn farmhouses, there's structures like that, but there's a lot of buildings within communities. And, you know, I think the primary buildings that most people are familiar with within a lot of your communities that you might recognize, those have been probably on the register. Your team has done that over the last several decades, probably since the mid 70s or something like that.
Right.
But there's always more interesting buildings that can be added. And I'd love to see us figure out, I mean, this is maybe something we should talk about offline, but I'd love to see even more of the buildings that are on campuses and public buildings get listed. But that's probably something too hot for a podcast radio right now. So,
well, perhaps
but
not.
But that's a fun thing as an architect.
Yeah. Sorry, Ben. No, I was just thinking that at SDSU, they renovated Lincoln Hall, which started as a library, then became the music building, and now is back to more of a traditional humanities and social sciences and foreign languages instruction goes on there now. And so it is that renovation has given that building a renaissance, I think, in purpose and scope, and added to its history, and certainly perked up that part of campus at SDSU. So, yeah, there's probably any number of buildings that could on public property that could be considered. But
and I don't think it's on the register, if I'm remembering right. I might be wrong about that. I don't think any of it. I'm not sure any of their buildings are on the register, although maybe the Campanile is on there. That what I would add is that Lincoln Hall project, if folks haven't seen it, they should walk through it. Cochazer did that work with the school and did a fantastic job, and it won an award this year at our AIA convention, and rightly so. It's really beautifully done, and they figured out a way to make it contemporarily functional while keeping all of the charm and history of it. So it was a nice project.
Right. It's a building that's nice to work in. The faculty offices there all have great lighting and natural lighting, and it's a great space for students
and
faculty.
You know, Ben, I wonder about that project because maybe it wasn't on the register. There was some interesting architectural moves that I think maybe they had a little more liberty to perform. For example, you know, when we're working on the register, there are some challenges, but they very thoughtfully opened up some openings and brought daylight and borrowed light into corridors and hallways and really added a lot of elements there that I wonder if they were really tightly following the Secretary of Interior's guidelines, if they may have been able to pull that off. But the end result is fantastic. And I feel like it captures the entire essence of what the Secretary of Interior guidelines would have hoped for, right?
Well, sometimes you can accidentally step into it, right? And get it right despite maybe a lack of explicit intention to do so. I'm not sure. Well, why don't we just back up a little bit? I think people might be unfamiliar with your comment there about the Secretary of Interior guidelines. And so, in fact, just recently, Yankton, the last weekend, we're recording this on the 18th, and last weekend on the 12th, Yankton celebrated the Meridian Bridge and its 100th birthday. That's another architectural creature of its day, right? It was kind of the local community and across the river in Nebraska raised the funds and got it built all with private loans and donations. The engineering of the 1920s stepped up and built this bridge that was necessary for the task at hand of getting car traffic across and perhaps railroad and so forth. But that became the kind of the venue for me to go visit them and share how the law that is governs our work for the Secretary of Interior standards on putting things on the register was first crafted. And it appears, I found out that Lady Bird Johnson, the First Lady of the United States in the 1960s, was very involved and interested in this project. And she gave explicit guidance in a study that was done, and that was then put in into the record of the debate on the floor of the Senate by the sponsoring senator, that we have to preserve buildings that speak to the past, but they also must be useful for the present in the local community around them, and they should contribute to the revenue and not just be a cost and a burden. And so she summed up beautifully, I think, what the law, the intention of what the Congress ultimately passed and the president signed into law, and kind of the parameters and the characteristics that we look for in determining what goes on the list. Does it meet these requirements, and is it a vital part of the community and its culture? That was interesting background that I had missed in my professional career. And so digging up this research about making some remarks that I came across the First Lady's comments, and I thought they very eloquently spoke to how historic preservation can meet a need of the present and the future, not just kind of marking the past.
I think you have an interesting job. Those are the kind of gems that would be really fascinating to discover.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful bridge on top of it.
You mentioned the Sisseton grounds. The Sisseton is an interesting place. We have both we recently listed both the Wachipi grounds. And then I think there are other things in the town of Sisseton that speak to the Norwegian immigrant heritage of that's in the area. And also the fort. I'm not sure if it's listed, but it certainly is a major part of the history of that region. And you kind of see in that microcosm a lot of the opportunity that the buildings even share. So But as an architect, how do you, with your schooling and training and professional background, when you go to a community and you look down the main street, what are some of the things that you look for that speak to the town's history? And I'm interested in the architect's eye in that.
Well, the segue you had with Lady Bird Johnson and sort of the viability and connections are required, you know, that's speaking a little bit of my language right now. It's not that I'm not intrigued and interested about any and all relevant quality architecture, but when you look at the core of those communities, those main streets, I think that there's a really great opportunity and a case that can be made for preserving those core historic buildings. So when I go down, and I get to go to them, I drive around the back roads of South Dakota all the time, probably like a lot of your listeners. We do a lot of K-12 work throughout the state, and I find myself in small towns and school districts throughout the state often. And I get to, if there's a chance to get a cup of coffee, or if there's a diner or something like that, I really enjoy checking that out. I want to see those buildings, and then I sort of think about what opportunities there might be to bring that particular historic building. And I'm really intrigued by the historic buildings that are in these towns. And there's so many really interesting, you know, an old bank building on a corner of any old small town, you know, there's basically and a lot of them are still standing, but how can you possibly make that a viable, how can you invest the kind of money required to make that building? It's one thing to get it on the register and I love it, and it's got an important history for that community. It's another thing to figure out how you're going to really save that building. And to save that building, it's going to take a substantial investment. And to do that, you have to make the case that this building can be a revenue generating structure. So that's kind of what it intrigues me a little bit, Ben, when I go and through these towns and start thinking about what's the opportunity here for that building.
Mm-hmm. And how have you seen that play out? You've got some experience in Aberdeen. I wonder if you want to just kind of walk.
Yeah, thank you. Aberdeen's my hometown. And one project we've been working on up there, the rest of my colleagues and I at Co-op Architecture have been kind of exploring this idea of exactly what I'm talking about, is how do we do that? I was walking by the Wells Block building in Aberdeen several years ago with a friend of mine, notable banker in town, Rod Folberg, who's retired. And he and I were walking by it, and I was complaining about this building. My understanding of the history of the Wells Block building is it's a family that originally invested in the Wells Lamont gloves that you might find at Ace Hardware. They have a building that's still named the Wells Block building. And it is a building in disrepair on Main Street in Aberdeen. And I was lamenting on it. And believe it or not, I had my first office there. I was paying $300 for rent in this building that has, you know, a bunch of the facade torn off. There's holes in it. It is in bad shape, and I'm certain it's in far worse shape now. And I was lamenting to this banker in town, and he said, "Well, why don't we fix it?" And I really wasn't prepared for him to make a call to arms on this deal. It was one of those things where I was just prepared to complain. And you know, I was like, "Well, what would we possibly do?" And he's like, "Well, let's buy it and fix it up." And I, you know, of course, I'm like, "Well, wow, hold on, we're just shooting the breeze here." So anyway, we actually did take a run at that building, and we couldn't get the deal to work. But what it did set in motion was, and then another attorney in town joined us. We ended up buying a series of low-hanging fruit buildings on Main Street that were really at the very bottom of value, that they have been in their entire history of 100 plus years. These old buildings, typically one, maybe two stories, typically 25 feet wide, which is the, you know, in Sioux Falls are 25 foot increments in Aberdeen is the property line, you know. So what we did was, and you'd be amazed at these buildings in every small town, Ben. They're hard to get your hands on because somebody has owned them for a long time and they're worth very little, but the property taxes on them are effectively zero. So, you know, somebody doesn't want to, they're not paying anything. It's basically a storage building, or maybe they have a consignment shop or some business in there that's paying a little bit of rent. So they're making a little bit of money. They pay no taxes. The building's been paid off probably for 30 years in many cases. There's very little incentive for some of these people in these kind of certain properties to do anything. So we had to kind of beg, people to sell their buildings that weren't worth anything to us, but knowing that they were going to take a substantial investment to fix up. We ended up finding some buildings, and we started with, you know, one building at a time. And we went out, and with Rod's help, we found 22 other investors to chip in 10 grand. We developed a system where we would have pledges, and we would get these folks to, you know, and by the way, Rod asked me to go out and ask everybody I knew. I did. They didn't give any money. Rod went out and asked everybody I knew, and they all gave money. Okay. So you need to have that kind of community player, right, Ben?
Right.
Because people would ask me, and they're like, you're doing what? And you want what? But when they talk to somebody in your community, and every community has a guy like that or a gal like that, that is the trusted kind of hometown hero type of player. And that is a key recipe to doing a project like this. But as we went, you know, we got a hold of one building. He helped us with the accredited investor rules, which I had no, I'd be in jail right now if I were, you know, if I were going to do this.
Yeah.
Because there's SEC rules, there's accredited investor rules, you know, confidential investor memorandums. And then we had budgets, and we had P&Ls and annual meetings, and there was a lot. And then the legal side with the attorney we added, another Rod Tobin, he helped set up the articles of organization or operating agreement. You know, there was easements, there's access, there's all kinds of assignments. And, you know, when you're purchasing it, you need somebody to handle that so they can handle the purchase agreements and closing statements. And the first building we bought was actually called the Curtis and Beeman building. And all of these buildings were not worth much, but we bought that. And all we wanted to do was, it's very simple. The strategy for this is fix up the facade a little bit, patch up the roof, and get it into the hands of somebody that can generate traffic, ideally some sales tax type of traffic. That's the plan. We can't do any more work because we have $220,000. And this is when we started this pre-COVID. So, you know, the money went slightly further, but that's not much money to do this work, to buy it and to do this work and then to try to roll it into the next one.
Right.
So we were able to do that. And then, you know, long story short, we were able to do that successfully, move on to the next, sell it, move on to the next one, do the same thing over again. And we did that four times with these small buildings. And, you know, the premise is what did you learn from? And it was not easy. And there was pro bono work by our firm and by everybody involved to do the actual work. We did have to pay contractors, but we got good key partners that gave us really good, fair prices. And we did all of this. The end result, though, Ben, that I think is really useful is we checked all of the property taxes in the 30 years since the mall. And the mall in a town like Aberdeen, and probably in a town, you know, I would argue Watertown, Huron, Pier, other places, just was very detrimental. It brought other advantages, right? And there were other good things that came with the mall, but it was really hard on property taxes and on historic buildings and on the investment of infrastructure in core parts of many communities, including in Aberdeen. So for 30 years, property taxes plummeted. And the buildings that we're talking about all had a property tax of around $1,000. And if you're doing 2%, you can understand that these buildings aren't worth much, sub $100,000, basically. And we noticed that, you know, in most cases, it went up 5-7%. Now, that's not a lot of money going from $1,000 to $7,000, but you realize with relatively little investment, we're bringing up that property tax. And if you would say, well, what if that building would have held that $7,000 from 1989 when the mall was built to today? Well, that's right. That's $500,000 between the four buildings that we just gave away in property taxes. Now, what would happen if that would have been escalating or improving in value? And what about the next 30 years that wouldn't get done if we'd not done this building? You know, it's millions of dollars. But then if you could say, this is just the four cheapest buildings downtown. What if we did that to 100 buildings, including the buildings that have more potential? You're talking about tens of millions of dollars in property taxes. That's not even sales tax dollars. And if you are thoughtful about the type of tenants that go into these or the types of owners that will go into them, and that also doesn't include the dollars that they're going to spend on the construction, remodel, renovation. And I'd like to think of all, so the value has to be made. And we built these charts that showed how property taxes changed and how it spiked immediately after the work that we did by beautifying them. And once you beautify four buildings it starts to become a little easier for the neighbor. And we started to see that while there was only between 2000 and when we started this in 2015-16, there was two buildings that had a project of more than $100,000 done. Since then, we've had about 11 or 12 buildings that have happened since we finished DART. Now, okay, we're just a puzzle piece in it. But the idea is momentum takes time, and momentum will affect your neighbors. And now we have all of these other projects happening that are also improving property taxes. And as you know, property taxes, you know, they don't necessarily pay for education, as you well know, Ben, but they are a formula used for bonding for capital improvements for schools. Critical.
Sure.
If you're bonding, you need property taxes. So, you know, it doesn't solve all your education problems at all, but let's face it, better facilities, easier to recruit teachers, better outcomes for students. And the idea is we want to have, you know, property taxes are just make a healthy community all the way around. The other thing is, can we get people out of cars, walking just a little bit more? What are the health outcomes? And right now we have a lot of tribal barriers out there. And if we can find ways to have more people building more community and coming together, I think there's some research that could be done on that too. And that's something we're intrigued by. So there's a lot of outcomes of why downtowns matter. And we want to try to pile these together as well as pull together all the incentives of like TIFs and historic tax credits and figure out, you know, how can we make the best case to say any downtown, you know, you can go build that new apartment building out on the edge of town, but what's the total maintenance and repair costs over time of that road, of that sewer, of that water, of all of the snow clearing that has to be done, of the, you know, when you're going to mill that road and re-asphalt road, like what is the cost of that versus all the infrastructure you paid for in your core and don't have to spend? And then, by the way, there's a lot of communities that need housing terribly. We work in all of these small communities that need housing badly for teachers, quite honestly, for teachers. Over and over and over, we hear it. Oh, we can't get anybody here because there's nowhere for the teacher to live. If we could figure out how to leverage a TIF or historic tax credits, or even to get the city to say, all we need is $100,000. $100,000. We're not asking you to build an apartment building. Help this development figure out a pathway to add 6 apartment buildings on the second floor of this building in Doland, right? Uh-huh. Just help do that through a TIF process or some other, you know, we have that 8-year tax moratorium that could be really useful. That's another way around that. Help figure out strategies here to do housing in these communities. We can connect all the dots through historic preservation. And when we got to the end of the day, we said all we did with DART was create a private facade grant program. But if we really want to do well, have the city chip in and let's do it over 10 years, $100,000. It can be public, private. And if you do it over 10 years, our belief is that you can do the greatest good, the greatest return on investment for your community can come through this facade grant program. And I think it can impact all facets of your community if you do this really well. So that's the strategy of what I look for when I go down Main Streets anywhere. And we've shared this idea with Watertown, with Mitchell, with several communities. And that's what we've been sort of like selling. I say selling, but preaching at these other AIA conventions. We're really diving deep now further into how we can quantify this to go in front of a council and say, let's try it.
So is the banker and your lawyer friends and so forth in Aberdeen, is it still a going kind of nonprofit, or how did you organize yourself for this?
Well, it was an LLC. That's a great question. We actually built booklets. I'd love to give you a link or figure it out. So we built a manual of how to do it. We share these books. We give them out. And I can give you a link, Ben, but we did an LLC for this business. I was sort of like, why wouldn't we do one of those 501c3s. why wouldn't we do one of those, man? I mean, those sound like the way to do it. Then you can be eligible for other funding. You know, Rod, the banker, basically said, yeah, that's fine, but we're going to move way too fast. We're going to have this LLC set up in 15 minutes. When I get back to the office, we're going to get all private money and we're going to knock this out and not be beholden to anybody. And before you know it, we're going to have projects done. So it was really a matter of him wanting to get stuff done versus the 501c3, which would have required some other obligations, you know, that you're supposed to do with those kind of entities. But you are eligible for more benefits. And I'm not opposed to other ways to set this up. This is just one pathway to do it.
Well, it's very interesting. And we will put the link to that PDF in the show notes, and folks can check it out when they about how your organization worked. I think that's fascinating, good stuff. I noticed on your website, too, that you kind of have a theme for your architecture for your firm about a South Dakota architecture. And you've got offices around the state, and you work, as you said, in K-12. And schools can be very formative buildings and places for students and for certainly for communities, a wide variety of things. And your work on the Capitol Commission, which is just a beginning. It's an interesting start. But how do you, when you conceive of a South Dakota architecture, what does that mean? Do you look at Wallace Dow's stuff and you kind of start from there, or is there other people along the way? We've talked about different schools of thought in architecture, and I think we put on, now I'm forgetting his name, but you'll probably the gentleman who designed the arena, the Sioux Falls Arena.
Spitznagel.
Right. He's kind of a part of that story. And he designed the church that I grew up in Sioux Falls. The First Presbyterian Church was a Spitznagel design.
Wow. Very good.
So there's a wide variety of things that he was involved in, and I think often can kind of just become part of the scene without a lot of thought about it. So, but to go back to my question, what's a South Dakota architecture look like, or how would you define that?
Yeah, Ben, it's a good question, and it's one that we've talked about a lot. You know, I think Wallace Dow, some would argue, kind of a father of certainly kind of the Sioux Falls region architecture, and a very influential architect for southeastern South Dakota and maybe beyond to some extent too. And courthouse and a lot of Richardsonian and a lot of quartzite, kind of rough-hewn quartzite, beautiful buildings, courthouse, some other beautiful buildings throughout, and other buildings too. But is that a South Dakota vernacular? You know, that's really Richardsonian. That's not really, there are elements of it that are very much Midwestern, rural, regional, but there are also elements of it that are part of a style, a national style, right? Or international style, perhaps. I think when we talk about regional architecture and the F-16s or whatever about to fly over, so I might get, I mean, this is regional. Could it get more regional than that?
The railroads and the fighter jets were
right outside my door here in downtown Sioux Falls. So, but the idea that, and I think you're right, you know, and I think Spitznagel is influential and important, and there's a lot of important architects. You know, I think up in my neck of the woods growing up in Aberdeen, there was an architect named Jacob Ellerby who ended up being a part of a firm called Ellerby Beckett that did a lot of influential buildings up in Aberdeen area historically. And I think there was Bell and Detweiler, I think, is the firm that did the Capitol. And they did the same Capitol in Montana.
Yes.
And there's a lot of these guys that came nationally that did a lot of the federal work. McKim, Mead, and White is a famous one that does Capitol buildings all over the country, or courthouses or post offices all over the country. I don't know if that's about regional architecture in the same way that we're talking about here. Eisentrout, I believe, is the name of the guy from that did a lot of Western South Dakota architecture of that kind. Courthouses, Carnegie buildings, things like that. Pretty influential. And he did some in the east side of the state as well, I think in Walworth and some others. But I've kind of talked with our group about the ruralness and that agrarian architecture, right? The farmhouse architecture. That when you go into a farmyard and you see this series of multiple buildings and the functionality of them. And the thing is there was a beauty to it, but certainly it's about light. It's about air. It's about functionality. And there's a real kind of beauty to that functionality that I appreciate. And I think that we could really latch onto as a community of architects and just our community more broadly. I would love to see elements of our history in our more contemporary architecture, because that'll serve, you know, some really interesting purposes. And even when you go to small towns and you look at the types of Main Street buildings, I do think that there's a beautiful functionality to a lot of those, and also some ornateness that's saying, you know, these are the things we value in this community. And I think that we haven't kind of like the mall, right? Like the pre-engineered metal building just derailed us for a while and continues mm-hmm. to derail us. And when you go into that same small town I'm talking about, the first 10 buildings you see are pre-engineered metal buildings. Now, pre-engineered metal buildings are actually, like, I have an appreciation for the effectiveness, for the cost effectiveness, for the efficiency of them, like how you can put together a structure this efficient that can serve this many functions, like big spans in them. You can do anything in them. They can be a gym. They can house your machinery. They can yeah. do anything. And there's a value to that. But what it's done is it sort of eliminated any sort of vernacular that I think has created a no place land. Like there's mm-hmm. nothing difference between the different towns you drive into anymore. And the only thing you can find that makes this town different than that town is when you get to the corner bank building on Main Street. And that's it. That's it. Yeah. So how do we sort of reinvigorate the sense of place that was there 100 years ago? And is there value in that? And I think there'll be winners and losers in this. But even when we get to metal buildings, and we did a community center up in Britain recently, a few years ago, and we said, well, what if we move the Perlins outside? You know, they came to us, great folks that wanted to do this great building and set a community center, and it looked like, a hog barn or just a shop building that you would store your machinery in. And they said, we're going to do this. That's going to be great. And we sort of thought, well, can we reinvent the pre-engineered metal building to do more, say more? And I think we're still contemplating ways that we can dissect the metal building, that we can figure out ways to express more with that building about the community than to mm-hmm. just have a metal shop building that has no sense of place. So that's an interesting component, is just the pre-engineered metal building, and the discussion around the architecture of that alone could be really interesting, because it's not going away. It's just too efficient, too cost effective, too functional. So there's that. But then beyond that is how we use the materials historically, and can we reintroduce those from the farmyard and from this agrarian sort of architecture too? And there's some architecture mm-hmm. firms kind of regionally that have done a fantastic job at doing that. And it's just like when you have different types of pitches and slopes, and what was the purpose of those, whether it's just shedding snow or creating shade, or what the functionality of some of these very basic forms was. Mm-hmm. And I love just the nature of kind of the multiple houses in a farmyard and how they function. So those are a lot of the conversations and then looking at schools, and like, are there elements of that for certain rural schools? Just bringing back a little bit of that architecture, in DeSmet, we just had the Laura Ingalls School, and we're like, is there any elements we can do to capture the sense of place of Laura Ingalls, So creating this corn crib sort of elements, or the shed roofs as opposed to all just flat roofs, or even just pitched roofs, and just do small moves, because let's face it, we're pragmatic. We're not going to pay a premium on it, but for very little to no money, we can do some things that do help create a sense of place. So right. You talk about that's stuff that we get pretty excited about over here. Our team likes talking about it.
At Dakota State, where I worked for a while, I can't remember the name of the firm, they had the contract to build the Beacon building that's there now, that houses a lot of their cyber and computer science programs. I had a sit down with the architect at the pretty near the beginning of the process, and I said, this is going to be across the street from East Hall, which was designed by Wallace Dow, and I kind of challenged them to come up with a way to tip their hat to Dow's architecture, and so they acknowledged that, and they, one of the reasons for the glass on what would be the west side of that building is to reflect East Hall back to the people as they approach the Beacon building. If the sun's in a certain place, they can look up at the side of the Beacon building, and the reflection will show East Hall, which is behind them. And so that was a nod to, Wallace Dow's work. And I thought, that's super clever. It's not only using modern materials in a modern way, but they kind of built that in with their intention of how that can enhance East Hall.
I'm appreciative of that effort. I mentioned that I consider myself a preservationist, and an advocate of historical buildings, but I'm also an advocate and interested in contemporary architecture, as long as that contemporary architecture takes into account its context. And I think that that's critical in any of this new architecture. But I do think understanding that architecture does change is relevant, and it's always changed. And I think that understanding new techniques, new materials is also equally interesting. So I appreciate what you said, that the reflective nature of East Hall in this new building is sort of an interesting metaphor in and of itself. And I like that.
Well, Tom, I certainly appreciate your work on the trustees and joining us here today on History 605. Give the listeners a sense of walking into the past by just walking in their downtown and seeing some of these older buildings and some of the names that put them there and designed them, and in addition to how they can be reused or repurposed for today, and maybe some vehicles that could get some of that done. So historic preservation is a big part of what the Historical Society does, and we certainly appreciate your part of that and your passion about the issue.
Thank you. Thank you for this program, which I enjoy, and also appreciate all the work that you're doing, Ben, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.